So meditation, yeah, so much to say about nothing, right? When people used to ask me, you know, what we did at our meditation center years ago, in my kind of smart alecky frame of mind, I would often say, well, we do nothing, but we do it really well. It's not easy to do nothing well. Because, you know, we're not human beings so much as we are human doings. And our doings often get us into a little bit of trouble. So what we'll be working with this meditation is one of what I refer to in my latest, this kind of beginner's book that I'm writing, one of the super techniques for lucidity. The others being belief, the power of belief, that cannot be overstated. You know, in the world of lucidity, you know, the maxim is, I will see it when I believe it. The power of belief cannot be overstated. It really is the basis of the placebo effect, which is really a belief effect where the mind can literally save a life, cure through the power of belief. It's the basis of the nocebo effect, which is the opposite of placebo, where the mind can damage the body. And a little bit circuitous, but there's some amazing literature about quite literally how the power of belief can kill, literally. And so if belief can save a life or end a life, we can surely use it to harness lucidity. So belief is incredibly important, you know, and this is so much of what we're doing in this week is reinstating the power of these practices and increasing our belief behind them. The other super technique, of course, and this is just a recap from the book, is intention. The power of intention cannot be overstated. In fact, I attended a teaching with Tsegyen Rinpoche. Many of you know him, a wonderful Tibetan master, talked about dream yoga. And the only induction technique, he gave was intention. You know, literally, etymologically, to stretch towards, stretching awareness, consciousness into previously unconscious domains. And so we will be working with intentionality quite specifically when we work in every evening with our little temple reconstruction project, you know, kind of harnessing intention. And then the fourth super technique, which I'll probably talk about tomorrow, is one that most people are completely unaware of. And it's the power, actually, of, Sanskrit, the word is Shila, practice of ethics, morality. It's very interesting, the role of ethics in the world of dream yoga. It's a big deal. So I'll get back to that tomorrow. But a little bit to say about this practice, actually a lot to say, a little bit now, a little bit later. You know, we'll be really reinstating and emphasizing the extraordinary importance of this thing called meditation. And one of the most important things, and again, I'm riffing on all this because if you believe it, you'll do it more. You know, you'll do not doing more. And really one of the central ideas here is that over the next week, I will be trying to introduce you to very subtle states of mind that are correlative to the subtlety of the mind as it's revealed when we sleep and dream. One of the reasons lucid dreaming and dream yoga is considered advanced is because it's so subtle. You're working with really subtle dimensions of mind, from fully gross, outer, loud qualities of mind, gross awareness, to more intermediate, subtle dimensions, to increasingly subtle and eventually formless dimensions. And the biggest reason we don't recognize these states of mind as they're revealed every night when we sleep and dream is because we haven't been introduced to them and we have not become familiar with them. And so we're going to be doing what my tradition sometimes calls a pointing out instructions, which really I really like to think of it more as pointing in instructions, to point out these subtle dimensions of mind as they manifest throughout the day, and then to become more familiar with them. which interestingly enough, of course, is the very definition of meditation in Tibetan. The word is gom, to become familiar with. It's so beautiful. You know, these are what are called zafus, but in my tradition, we have these square cushions. They're called gom dens. Literally means seats of familiarization. You go to a temple in India, Nepal, Tibet, they're called gompas, places of familiarization, where one becomes familiar with these, you know, increasingly refined subtle states of mind. And so the logic here is very straightforward. I mean, how do we expect to meet in the darkness of the night something that we haven't met in the full light of the day, right? So what we want to do is point out and then exercise the daily or diurnal correlates to these nocturnal states. And so this is why, you know, so many studies have shown this. This is not a mumbo jumbo. Many, many studies have shown that meditators have more lucid dreams. In the mind of a meditation master, all their dreams are lucid. There's no such thing as a non-lucid dream in the mind of a meditation master. And the logic is completely obvious. You know, if you were introduced to and become familiar with these states of mind now, you will recognize them then. And it's like, you know, the poet Kabir once said of death, also applies to dream, what is found now is found then. Or, in the untrained mind, what is not found now is not found then. So, this practice works with, scientists use this term, it's a pretty intuitive term. Meditation, therefore, works with this theme of bidirectionality. Neuroscientists talk a lot about this. And that is that what we do during the day obviously affects what we do at night. And the really cool thing, and we'll be unpacking this, what we do at night, especially with dream yoga, feeds back in and affects what we do during the day. It's just a natural cycle. You know, these two states cross-pollinate, whether we know it or not. You know, when we sleep at night, it's just the mind revealed, free of sensory constraint. Right now, the mind is constrained by sensory input. Consciousness is constrained by our physicality. When we dream, those physical constraints are dropped, but it's the same underlying mind or consciousness that is revealed. And so, if we work with these during the day, those same tenets extend towards the night. And then the insights that we glean from the night, from these nocturnal practices, they then cross-pollinate, come back in, and start to affect our day. So you're replacing this unconscious, vicious cycle, negative feedback, with a conscious, positive, virtuous cycle, where what you do, your practice of lucidity during the day, again, lucidity is a code word for awareness. So when we do these meditations, what are we doing? We're working with awareness. A lucid dream is an aware dream. So we work with those now so that we can have the fruitions when we sleep. And so again, the logic here, it's not quite a syllogism, but it's close, is that thoughts are to waking consciousness as dreams are to dreaming consciousness. Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it? Thoughts are to waking consciousness as dreams are to dreaming consciousness. And if really, again, there's no magic here. This is basic causality, karma, physics. You know, if you want to realize why you're so non-lucid to the contents of your dream at night, just look at the relationship you have to the contents of your mind during the day. And any meditator that sits for more than 10 minutes will realize that there is this constant stream of thought. Western psychology estimates about 60,000 thoughts a day. The Bun tradition, which is the indigenous shamanistic tradition of Tibet, estimates some 80,000 thoughts a day. And so when you engage in meditation, and this is what makes it initially somewhat challenging, is you start to realize that there's, you know, the main CNN broadcast taking place, right? But underneath it is the CNN crawler, what Trungpa Rinpoche talked about as subconscious gossip. Underneath that is a yet a more subtle ripple of sub-subconscious gossip. I mean, all these waves of movement and distraction And so when you engage in the practice of meditation, you're bringing these unconscious processes into the light of consciousness, into the light of your awareness. And at the initial stages, this revelatory process, this is why the moniker for dream yoga in Tibetan, of course, is it's the measure of the path. You know, dreams, even psychologically, will show you where you are, especially when you're the adult editorial function of the prefrontal cortex, the executive parental guidance of the mind is released in the dream state. And that's why all these incredibly uncensored things happen, because the PFC is shut down. And so dreams are highly revelatory. They will reveal where you are in your meditation practice. And so what we want to do is develop a more lucid relationship to the contents of our mind. It's really that straightforward. And so we do so by becoming lucid to the contents of our mind. A non-lucid thought, just like a non-lucid dream, is a distracted thought, a forgotten thought. You know, a thought arises, and OMG, even though there isn't one, how many times does this happen during the day? A thought arises, you get hooked. It's what Pema Chodron wrote so famously about a shempa. You know, it hooks you, hooks your awareness, and you're off. You're off. You're off. Every single time that happens, and if you're honest with yourself, it happens all the time. That's an unconscious practice of non-lucidity. And this is, in fact, why we're virtuosos in the art of non-lucidity, because we're practicing it all the time. This is the pisser. This is part of this charter of bringing unconscious processes into the light of consciousness, is that whether we know it or not, and the big pisser is most of us do not know it. This is the archetypal blind spot. We do not see that we do not see. We are always meditating. We are always becoming increasingly familiar with either mindfulness or mindlessness, either distraction or non-distraction, either forgetfulness or remembrance. Look at your own mind. Is this not the case? The mind is always meditating. And so, again, you want to know why you're having so many non-lucid dreams at night? It's because you're practicing non-lucidity all of the time. It's just it's a revelation of our constant practice. And so now we want to bring this unconscious process into the light of consciousness via the map. This is me, this is the hearing part. You'll reflect on this naturally. And then, obviously, into your system through the practice of meditation, where you'll sit there and you'll say, wow, this is amazing. And a very common complaint in the initial stages of meditation, anybody here who is a meditation instructor knows this, you know, within a couple of weeks or months of meditation, a student will come to you and say, this meditation thing is bullshit. Is it okay if I use adult language here? You know, my life was, my mind was never this crazy. My mind was never this wild. Well, excuse me, sorry. Yes, it was. You just never saw it before. And so, you know, this is so fantastic. It's like, you know, my teacher and many of you know this great master, Trungpa Rinpoche, my root teacher, he was the master of the one-liner. And I will be riffing a bunch of his one-liners. You know, he says this beautifully. He says, you know, meditation, of course, meditation is not a sedative. Meditation is a laxative. Meditation is a laxative. Once you release, once you open, everything that you have repressed, all the S-H-I-T, can I use four-letter words? Yeah. All the shit that you've lodged into your unconscious mind, which, as I will show you probably this afternoon, is nothing more than this. This is your unconscious mind. It's called your body. Everything that you've thrown down there when you engage in meditation, guess what's going to happen? It's going to come back up. And so when you engage in meditation, if you've done this for more than a week, you realize all this crap, all this refuse, all the refused experience, the things that you say no to, where does it go? Does it just like dissolve someplace in space, the Dharmakaya? Maybe eventually, no. What we refuse in conscious experience is transformed into the refuse heap. I love this double entendre. What we refuse is thrown into the refuse heap of the unconscious mind, which is this. And so when we engage in meditation, guess what happens? All this shit comes up. So when you start the meditative path, that's why I wrote my first book, The Power and the Pain, read the small print. We need our lawyers here, Myra. You know, we need a lawyer. Bring the spiritual contract before you sign it. Read the small print that says, brace yourself, Bridget. Because when you engage in this practice, you're asking for it. You're asking for this refuse heap to be revealed. And that is a tremendous blessing. But from a convenience, comfort, egoic point of view, no day at the beach. No day at the beach, right? I mean, is this like, I see some heads nodding, yeah? Does this kind of make sense? So, you know, you better run while you can. I will not give you your money back, but you better run while you can. The Trungpa Rinpoche said, you know, better not to start. But if you do start, better to finish quickly. Detox. It's like I wrote in the chapters that I sent you. Detox. We're detoxifying from this addiction to non-lucidity, this passion for ignorance, as Martin said. You know, this practice will reveal your passion for ignorance, your lust for non-lucidity, your lust for sleep. Ah. So we're going to throw a cold bucket of water to wake you up from that. So, okay, so let me just do it again. So much to say, but that's enough for now. I will, again, refine. I will guide you through this practice, and this morning will be the most kind of voluminous description, just because I want us all to be on the same page. And then as we progress, much less commentary on the actual technique, because the technique, as you'll see, is unbelievably simple. And this is what really brings about the power. The profundity comes from the simplicity. The complex mind does not stand a chance against simplicity. So with this practice, the invitation is surrender to it. This comes from the bowels of ancient Indian history. Surrender to it. Don't try to outsmart it. Don't try to outthink it. Don't try to get it. Give in to it. Let it do its magic on you. So in a certain sense, it could not be simpler. And that paradoxically is what makes it so hard. For human doings, the art of being is not so easy. And so nothing could be simpler than just surrender, open. That's another meta-narrative. Open to the power of this practice. And so here's the way it goes or doesn't go, right? Here we don't go. The practice is called shamatha, beautiful word in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, the word is shine. Literally means the practice of tranquility, the practice of peace. I really like that. It's like, hey, honey, I'm going downstairs to practice tranquility. She says, go for it, baby. You need as much tranquility as you can get. I'm going to practice peace. Peace, by the way, again, I'm a Gemini. I'm not into astrology, but people tell me that Geminis love words. Is that true? Wordsmiths, right? Yeah. Gemini. So peace actually comes from a word that means to fasten. How interesting is that? To fasten. So what we're going to do in a very gentle way is we're going to fasten. We're going to tether this wild, untamed mind. We're going to fasten it to this body which is fastened to this earth. And from there, we start to see things we've never seen before. Ah, we start to become lucid to non-lucid processes. So the first phase is all about body. Okay? Body. Your body is your personal earth. And we will be saying quite a bit about body. I think you will be surprised at the extraordinary profundity, the magic of what this soma has to offer. So we're going to use this body while we have it. Because when we die, this anchor is going to be cut. And the mind is going to be set free, just like in a dream. And if we can't handle that freedom, if the mind has not been tamed to that degree that when the anchor is cut and the mind is set free, the ensuing openness, emptiness, groundlessness results in a sense of panic. That panic, in fact, becomes the very fabric that hurls us involuntarily, allegedly, in these wisdom teachings back into another involuntary rebirth, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. So we start with this amazing body. And I describe this meditation in three phases. This is just my style. There's so many ways to teach this. And these three phases, they interpenetrate. In this case, it's not just bi-directional, it's tri-directional. These are the phases of body, breath, and mind, or body, speech, and mind. And in many ways, the body part is the most important. So we're going to start with that. And to show you how important this is, there's so many ways to point this out. Go ahead and just close your eyes for a moment. No instruction whatsoever. Just close your eyes for a moment and simply do a weather check. What's the weather like in here today? Don't change a thing. Just like be a dispassionate observer. And what's the weather like in there today? Probably a little breezy, a little windy, probably a little movement. Now I'm going to invite you to notice this profound relationship between body and mind, between the posture of the body and the posture of the mind. Again, another instance of this bidirectional process. And notice how your mind changes with the following very subtle adjustment to your body. Smile. Just raise the corner of your lips. What, 3.5 millimeters? Doesn't your mind smile when your body smiles? Doesn't it? Doesn't it? Paul Ekman is a very interesting researcher. He's the world's leading researcher on facial expressions. And when he was doing his studies, mapping the 250 forms of facial expression, he noticed that when, for instance, he was taking on the facial expression associated with depression, he found himself getting depressed. So we're going to use this phenomenology, this bi-directional process, of body and mind and body, top down, bottom up, to use the body to work with the mind. This is one of the central narratives we'll be doing, and the subtleties here, I think, will really be provocative for you. So you can open your eyes. So what we're going to therefore do is use our body to tame, train, and entrain the mind. We're going to use the posture of the body, the lucid body, that's the narrative for today. We're going to use a lucid body to invoke a correlative lucid state of mind. And so right away I have to interject, there's an attitudinal issue here, where right off the bat we're going to bring down an attitude, a posture of mind into our body. And here by that what I mean is you want when you sit to bring an attitude of dignity, of strength, of immutability, and as we say in the Shambhala teachings, even nobility, even regality, as if you are taking your seat in the kingdom of your own mind. And so the posture is already imbued in a top-down way with this kind of attitudinal posture. Wow, this body is amazing. Strong, stable, dignified, beautiful, regal. And then with that, then we'll build our way up. So, legs are crossed, so many different ways, half lotus, full lotus, whatever works for you. If you're sitting on a chair, invitation is feet planted firmly, squarely on the ground. You want to feel your connection to the gentle sanity of this earth. the beauty, the elegance, the nobility, the stability of this planet. Fasten to that. Rest your hands on your thighs. Or if you like, the cosmic mudra. Again, so many variations. If your hands are on your thighs, not too far forward, not too close in. It's theme of the middle way. Connect, feel your buttocks touching the cushion, touching the earth. Entrain your body to the sanity of this stable, good earth. As we come up, your back is firm but not stiff. It's not military, but it is upright. It is, again, stable. The stability of your torso represents kind of the masculine quality of fearlessness, immutability, indestructibility, strength. With this spine, you can weather anything. And yet that's balanced, tempered with an open, more feminine heart. Receptive, accommodating, spacious. And so the two central ingredients, you could say, of meditation, fearlessness and gentleness, are literally embodied and represented in your posture. We want to establish a gentle but fearless relationship to our mind. And our body represents that. Shoulders are pulled back. Heart is exposed. In both Pali and Sanskrit, heart and mind are the same word, citta. So when we work with mindfulness, we're working with heartfulness. That's another definition of this meditation. It's not just a cerebral cognitive event. It's a heart event. It's an affective event. It's a body event. And I have found somewhat magically, if there is one central instruction for the body, as in fact it is for meditation, it's opening your heart. Not being afraid to expose who you are. I work with this a lot because I protect myself with my thinking mind, with my intellect. My character armor is slouched shoulders, protecting my heart, head leaning forward because I'm always heading in the wrong direction with too much of my left brain. And so for me, I have to really practice to pull my shoulders back, not be afraid to reveal my heart. Put this ridiculous 10-pound bowling ball that rests on my shoulders back in line with my heart, which for me means bringing it back. Almost like you're reining it in. Way, baby, whoa. You don't belong that far out there, no. Center your heart above your heart, your head. Center your head above your heart. In this practice, there are several variations here, which we'll explore. Head is tipped ever so slightly forward. For now, and we'll change this later, your eyes are open. Your visual field is receptive, accommodating, spacious, which invokes correlative state for your mind's eye to be spacious, accommodating, and receptive. So it's unfocused, diffuse, open. T- tongues resting on the back of the upper teeth, subtle refinement that reduces salivary flow. Lips ever so slightly parted, as if you're whispering the word, ah. And with these simple stages and steps, you've established the earth, the platform, the ground. Truly the most important step. Phase two could not be simpler. A natural awareness, mindfulness to the movement of your breath. You don't visualize it, you don't imagine it, you simply feel it. It's literally the movement of life. We are so close to death. You only have to breathe out. Don't breathe back in. And you're dead. You've launched. Appreciate, celebrate this elixir of life. So at this point, it couldn't be easier. You're simply sitting and breathing. Life 101. But you're trying to do so without approximation. You're trying to do so fully, completely, great completeness, completely. And so with these two incredibly simple foundations intact, the third phase, of course, is the mind phase. And this is such genius, the way these meditation masters came up with this, because what we have done with this posture is we have created a kind of contrast medium of stasis, of non-movement, that allows us to now better see the movement of our mind. That's all that thought is. In Vajrayana language, thought is movement of mind. And so what we have done that is so provocative to me is by sitting in this way, we have removed the camouflage that otherwise distracts us from establishing a relationship to our mind. During the course of our day, through the incessant busyness, the movement of the day, that acts as a type of camouflage that obscures and hides the play, the movement of the mind. Remove the camouflage and hola. OMG, look at all the stuff in here. Wow. This is what you'll see is the Vipassana component. I'll come back to that later. Stop and see. Shamatha and Vipassana. Stop and see. You can't see when you're racing along in the human race, heading towards nowhere. And so in this last phase, again, it could not be simpler. Whenever anything arises that distracts you, that steals your awareness, doesn't matter, thought, image, anticipation, regret, doesn't matter. Whenever you find yourself distracted, In the context of these nocturnal meditations, you say to yourself very gently, very precisely, very kindly, wake up. Come back to your body and breath. Wake up. Come back to your body and breath. Because every time you get lost in thought, that's a micro instance of non-lucidity of sleep. And so we'll do this for a few minutes. Maybe take a question or two, and then we'll take our break.
So a couple very short comments before our break. I taught at Kripalu Institute in the spring, and there was a beautiful little quotation from Kripalu that I really quite like, where he says, "The highest spiritual practice is self-observation without judgment." I thought that was pretty good. So a couple little thingies. When you feel discomfort, which is inevitable, your knee hurts, your ankle hurts, your back hurts, your neck hurts, your mind hurts, your heart hurts, your wrist hurts, your nose hurts. The invitation here is to work with impulsivity. Third skanda, for those of you who know these terms, work with impulsivity and notice the immediate tendency to scratch, move, whatever. And maybe spend 10, 15 seconds to relate. Oh, how interesting. My left knee hurts. Let me establish a brief relationship to this thing called pain. Oh, how interesting. I got an itch here. Well, take a second to establish a relationship to this thing. And then do what you need to do. This practice is a practice of maitri, of kindness towards oneself. There's discipline, but, you know, the form... not too tight, not too loose. You're not masochistic here. If you're sitting in a chair, the invitation, I forgot to mention this, is, again, do what feels right for you, but the invitation is to pull your back away from the support. It's a representation of, I can do this by myself. I don't need to lean on anything. I have the capabilities. Remember, the ultimate guru is here. I can do this. And when a thought, whatever, arises, and you label it wake up, and of course, there are different contexts of this. The original instruction is to label it thinking. But here we want to label it wake up. Pay attention to the voice that you use. It's not, oh, wake up, dumb shit. It's just, wake up. It's not a reprimand. You're not spanking your mind. You're not using a hammer. You're popping a bubble with a feather. Very gentle, very precise. And it's not a reprimand, and this cannot be overstated. Thoughts are not the enemy. Thoughts are the natural play, the natural radiance, the natural shine of the mind. Thoughts are the children of your mind. And unless you're a wacko, you're not going to beat up your kids and slap them around. You're going to love your kids the way now we want to love our mind. Love the contents of your mind. I'll come back to this later when I give you some tips about how to work with insomnia. very important. So when a thought arises, it's not a reprimand. It's not a hammer coming down. Oh, whack, let's kill that sucker. Or you're sitting there like a sniper, you know. Here comes another one. Ping! No, a thought arises. Oh, how interesting. Feather. Pop the bubble with the feather. Boop. It's an act of recognition. And as we'll see, this is another underlying theme. One of the most frequently reported sentences in the classic Tibetan Book of the Dead, which applies so beautifully here, is recognition and liberation are simultaneous. Oh, what a line. Recognition and liberation are simultaneous, just like in a dream. When you recognize the dream, you're liberated from being trapped in the non-lucid dream. So the idea here, a loving relationship, it's not a reprimand, it's an act of recognition. It's an act of lucidity. That is a micro instance of lucidity. Oh, awake. Come back. Awake. Come back. Nothing easier in the world, nothing more difficult. Right? Okay, let's take a little break. We're still in silence. Again, work with the impulsivity. And I always say when we're transitioning, usually what happens, and remember yoga, the colloquial usage of the word yoga here is to stretch. We want to stretch the contemplative, meditative, lucid mind into all states. And usually what happens is when we finish our meditation sessions, we do some abbreviated version of a backflip off the cushion and run screaming out the door. Oh, I can take refuge in my busyness, my distractedness, my activity. So when we're in formal meditation, the invitation is open, relax, 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 open, relax, relax. When we get up in so-called post-meditation, we tighten a little bit. And so what I always do now, always, is when I finish a meditation session, and we will do it right now, we stand up. Mindfully. Notice how when almost the minute you start to move, you start to lose. And so what I always do, I finish a meditation session at home, I do standing meditation. It's one of the classic meditation postures in the classic meditation texts, like the Satipatthana Sutra. I just stand. Open. I'm about to transition into my world. I'm fundamentally really about to lose it. Right? Notice how you lose it when you start to move. The camouflage is back. Oh, here I am. Oh, I feel so, oh. Oh, lust for non-lucidity. Oh, it feels so good. After this meditation stuff. Ah, no. And then for the first couple steps, the third sanctioned practice, of course, is walking meditation. The fourth, of course, is lying down. We'll do that later. And so for the first two or three or four steps, as long as you can handle it, bring your awareness to your body. And then run off back into your samsaric agenda. So slow, correlative to still is slow, mindful. We're still in silence for a couple, hour and a half. 10, 15 minutes. If we say 10, it always means 15. Probably have time to get a drink or a little nibble down there, whatever. But really come back here somewhat promptly so we can have a nice hour before. Okay? Slow, slow, kale, kale. Mindful.